Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, the state of Utah, as promised, sues over President Biden's upsizing of national monuments that had been downsized by former President Trump. The latest in the legal challenge to the state's actions in redistricting. And later in the show, a deep dive with the Associated Press journalist whose reporting showed that an LDS church sex abuse helpline can actually divert abuse complaints away from law enforcement, leaving children in danger. All that and more on the show this morning. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. And welcome, Brian.
Yeah, good to be back.
Great to have you here. Also joining us, we've got Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke as well. And good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning, Roger.
Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW, and we will try and respond there. Brian Maffley, a move that we expected for quite a while, I think. Utah sues over President Biden's restoring of national monuments in Utah after they were cut down by President Trump. So tell us what this suit is about. What is the goal of the lawsuit, and what's the rationale the state is using?
Yeah, this lawsuit has been a long time coming. The Attorney General, Sean Reyes, has been talking about it even before President Biden restored the two monuments in Utah, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. They hired an outside law firm, Consovoy McCarthy, whose lead attorney on the case is Utah's former Solicitor General Tyler Green. They got the contract to kind of manage this litigation that is expected really to go through the district court here in Salt Lake City and wind up one side or the other will appeal. And we believe the goal ultimately is to get this case before the Supreme Court, where they have a favorable majority that would interpret the Antiquities Act to their liking, which is that these monuments that Democratic presidents have been designating that exceed, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres are beyond the scope of the Antiquities Act, and they're claiming it's an abuse of it.
Cite language that says that the Antiquities Act requires the smallest area compatible with the proper care and management of the qualifying landmark, structure, or object. What does that mean? I'm reading.
Yeah, well, what that means is that is the crux of this case, and what it means is needs to be sorted out. And as far as the environmental community is concerned, it's already been sorted out through years of prior decisions by the Circuit Courts of Appeal and the Supreme Court that smallest area compatible with the proper management of those resources actually can be pretty big. There's case law going back to when Grand Canyon National Monument was designated by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1908, and there was Arizona fought that for many years, and it wound up before the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the large monument. And of course, it's now that monument has become quite a bit larger and is now one of the most beloved national parks.
Right.
So you'll figure.
I guess, yeah, courts have upheld these monument declarations, even in, you know, if they're quote-unquote sprawling size, with all that included. So the goal is to get this in front of the Supreme Court. Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. I think the plan. We'll be doing some additional reporting on that. I think we need to just give a little bit of context here to talk about these lawsuits. So President Clinton designated the Grand Staircase in 1996, 1.9 million acres, give or take. That was one of the biggest national monument designations of all time, if you don't include the marine ones, which are hundreds of millions of acres, I guess.
Right.
And then in 2016, as he was leaving office, President Barack Obama designated the Bears Ears in San Juan County 1.3 million acres. So both of these are, two of the largest national monuments managed by the Bureau of Land Management. Everyone agrees they're very large. What there is a lot of disagreement on is is it appropriate for presidents to designate entire landscapes as national monuments? In this case, the tribes and the environmental community says, yeah, the landscape itself is the resource to be preserved. And if you're just doing little postage stamp things here and there, you're not protecting the connecting public lands. And so the state of Utah has taken a completely opposite view, and they want to get that view tested before a Supreme Court, which has already signaled that it is open to their argument. And that was when that signal came from Chief Justice Roberts, who issued a kind of unofficial opinion a couple years ago, kind of challenging this idea of large national monuments being appropriate under the Antiquities Act. So I have a feeling that, you know, given Chief Justice Roberts, it's already stated public position here that they're going to want to take this case. And as we've seen in the Dobbs case, this Supreme Court is not, is very open to upsetting established law.
Yeah, and I guess that's, I mean, right, the crux that you're describing there is a difference of opinion about what the smallest size possible means, meaning for those who are opposed to monuments, there's a spearhead on the ground, protect that thing there, more or less, or ruins, and then for the environmental community and others, it's the landscape itself and all of the sort of ecosystem
and involved. Secretary of the Interior under Obama, Sally Jewell, articulated that case very well during her trip out here in, what was that, 2016, to investigate the proposal by the five tribes to designate a bear's ears.
Yeah. You point out in your story that, actually, let's start with the, when in announcing this suit, there's a statement from Utah's federal delegation and from state leaders.
Yeah.
And the statement says that the monuments, as they are declared, you know, with the size that they have, that they do the opposite of protecting the monuments. Can you talk about
They offered no evidence to support that, I might point out. But it's a credible argument that there's a lot of visitation that's coming to these places because of the monument designation, and these designations don't give the Bureau of Land Management the resources necessary to manage it. Okay, yeah, I guess that's a fine theory, but you need to have evidence to back that up if you're going to say these landscapes are getting ruined because of this visitation. The irony of the bear's ears is that the cultural resources there were getting ruined by local residents who were looting these sites. There's no dispute over that. So the tribes felt that to put an end to that, the landscape needs to be protected. So,
what has the tribe's response been to what the state is doing with this suit?
Pretty much silence.
Okay.
You know, they haven't really come out swinging. Now the environmental groups have. They have denounced Utah's lawsuit as just a frivolous gesture of wasting taxpayer dollars. Undermining what polling suggests the majority of Americans support these monuments. You know, you don't see this controversy in other states that host large national monuments like Colorado, Nevada, California. They all, Montana, all have huge national monuments.
Huh.
And designated by Clinton, Barack Obama, are the two leading culprits, you know, on how you want to...
Right.
Your perspective. But those states aren't making a big issue of it. And when, you know, Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke did his review of all of the large national monuments out west, well, he only recommended reductions to two, and they happen to be in Utah.
So then why, this might be a question maybe for Robert, but why is it being made an issue here in Utah? Why has it become the issue that it has become in the state of Utah if it's not so controversial in other states? If you can't answer that,
I can't answer it. I mean, I can speculate that it has to do with Utah's, you know, generational distrust of the federal government and resentment of, you know, this oversight out of Washington, D.C. over the majority of the land in this state.
Hmm. Kirky, any thoughts on just, I mean, what Robert, what Brian described ended up in my ears kind of sounding like a political, you know, cause, a cause célèbre.
Yeah, I mean, like Brian touched on, there is this longstanding resentment or hostility toward anything that has to do with the federal government. In particular, their land management practices and their land ownership in the state. And so for any of these politicians to, you know, come to the table and work in good faith is just a bridge too far for these guys. So they're going to plant the flag and they're going to fight to the last man. I think I will say that the part of the reason some of the other states don't have this same sort of or the same level of hostility is they've been exempted from future monuments under the Antiquities Act.
Alaska and Wyoming.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they did have their share of hostility toward the monuments, but they've been exempted by statute. And there have been attempts by Senator Mike Lee and others to try to exempt Utah from future monument declarations as well. So, yeah, I mean, but as Brian mentioned, this has a long history now. I mean, in 1996, when Grand Staircase was first designated, there was a lawsuit over that one. And when Bears Ears was first designated, the state sued over that one, and it was shrunk, and the environmentalists sued over that one. And it's a quarter century of litigation at this point that probably has another 5 years ahead of it at least, and before we get any resolution. And in the meantime, you know, I think one of the points that the state and federal delegation make is this, you know, teeter totter back and forth
of
management for these resources. I think it would be in everybody's best interest if we could find some solution, some resolution. And as much as, you know, the governor and the senators and the congressmen talk about wanting to find some permanent solution to make sure this is managed, none of them are actually coming to the table with any good faith proposals. They throw out these little dinky plots, like you said, that are, you know, protecting these isolated ruins or whatever, and everything in between them is free game at that point. It's not going to get resolved anytime soon, just because there's no good faith negotiations or willingness to give an inch.
Brian, yeah. You point out in your reporting, you point out that the San Juan County Commission, they are in a county where there's a big chunk of national monument, and they are in favor, or they're opposed to the state suing over this. Is that, how big of a deal is that for the state's, I don't know, legal case?
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting here that, you know, Kane and Garfield County are participants in the lawsuit. Those are the counties at the Grand Staircase. And San Juan is not. And I wouldn't be surprised if San Juan County intervenes on the other side in this case. It's worth noting that when the monument was designated in 2016, the San Juan County Commission was, you know, vehemently against the monument designation. They have since had a special election, and two members of the Navajo Nation, who also are Democrats, were elected, and they are extremely pro-monument. That fact, they might, you know, they might prefer to see it even larger than the 1.3 million acres. That's Kenneth Maryboy and Willie Gray Eyes. Commissioner Bruce Adams is, I presume, still opposed to the monument. But as a majority, that commission is supportive of the monument and would like to see it remain.
Also, I mean, I guess maybe it's worth pointing out also that just a day after the suit was announced by the state of Utah, the Bureau of Land Management came forward with a sort of management plan or the process
for
management.
They initiated the management planning process.
So for Bears Ears.
Yeah. So during the Trump years, new management plans were created for the Grand Staircase, and then a plan for the reduced Bears Ears. Which was, under Trump, it was 200,000 acres, non-contiguous units, one at Comb Ridge, the other at Indian Creek. So at the time, a lot of folks didn't even participate in that process because they felt that it would be legitimizing Trump's action. So now the shoe is on the other foot. The BLM and Forest Service have initiated a new planning process that happens to get announced the day after this lawsuit's filed. And interestingly, I talked to the state Public Lands Office about this, and the state fully intends to participate in this planning process, even though if the state gets its way in this lawsuit, an injunction would get issued that would prevent the Biden administration from implementing his designations. Well, this planning process would have to come to an end. So here's the state saying, wanting to put an end to the planning process, but now participating in it. And you know, I actually think it's probably a smart thing for them to do. They're hedging their bets, right?
Yeah. You
know?
Yeah, just in case. I mean, you've got to be on.
You might lose.
Yeah, I guess just in case could go either way. Again, Robert Gerke, maybe just to kind of close this out, this feels a little bit like deja vu. You know, we're all over again. We're doing this thing forever. Is it going to require a Supreme Court ruling for you know, over the Antiquities Act for us to have any kind of finality?
I don't even know if that would give you the finality, because then there'd continue to be congressional efforts to try to revamp it. You know, it is going to ultimately probably end up in the Supreme Court, or even though, as Brian mentioned, there is a long history of court rulings that support the designation of monument or the president's authority to designate these monuments. You know, we're going to keep fighting about it. And I think ultimately, again, if we could get people to the table, get the congressional delegation to negotiate in good faith, get the state to come up with a realistic proposal to acknowledge, at least at the very least, that over the 26 years that the Grand Staircase has existed, it's been a benefit to the communities surrounding it.
Yeah.
And the locals, as Brian mentioned, in San Juan County are supportive of it. Not necessarily the locals that you know, the governor and the delegation want to point to, but the majority of the locals. You know, I don't know that the animosity toward these monuments is necessarily as extreme as it once was. I think it's been a generation since the Grand Staircase was designated, and I think, you know, it hasn't been the end of the world, and so maybe there is over time going to be some easing of the animosity.
I have to admit that it feels different than it did, than it has felt in the past in terms of the level of vitriol discourse, Brian.
You know, Robert raises a really interesting point here. The state's talking points have completely changed. Anti-monument talking points, that is, have completely changed since 2016. So if you, that joint statement you referenced, Roger, it talks about how the monument designation it will impede the BLM from doing the best job possible of managing these very precious resources. So they're acknowledging these are great resources, geological, scenic, cultural artifacts. And so previously they were arguing that these monument designations were strangling local economies. Well, they've walked away from that, and I think part of it is there's not a lot of evidence to back up this idea that the Grand Staircase Monument is harming the economies of Kane and Garfield County. It's just the opposite. I mean, if you could take a time machine back to Kanab to 1996. Compared to now, that town is booming. Same with Escalante, and so they seem like they don't want to look like they just want to have a coal mine and uranium mines on Cedar Mesa. They want to look like they want to protect these lands, and they have this phrase in there that the stewardship is best if it's left with those closest to the land. And I think people in the environmental community would see that as code for, you know, letting ranchers call the shots. But at the very least, it's what they're saying is people like, you'd think that the tribes and county commissioners should get a larger say here. Well, I guess it doesn't count for the Bears Ears, because the tribes and these Native Americans who live near Bears Ears want to see it protected as a national monument.
Well, and as you pointed out in your story, the San Juan County Commission as well, it would seem. With that, Brian Maffley is public lands and environment reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you very much for filling us in on all of this. I'm sure there's more to say, but I'll direct people to your stories at sltrib.com.
Hey, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about another lawsuit, this one over gerrymandering and where that stands currently. We'll be back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning live Utah news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW or calling 801-355-TALK. Robert Gerke, you reported on the lawsuit which contends that Utah's new congressional maps are an unconstitutional gerrymander. A couple of things that happened in this case this week. Maybe you can kind of give us just a quick reminder on what the lawsuit is about. It's about the redrawing of congressional or of maps of district of voting maps in Utah.
Yeah, every 10 years, the Utah legislature will redraw the boundaries, political boundaries, based on the census numbers that come out. And you know, it's been an issue across the country where Democrats draw the maps to favor Democrats as much as they can, and Republicans draw them to favor Republicans as much as they can, and both are trying to, you know, expand their political power. The people that end up losing are the minority party. So in Utah, you have about 30-35% of the population typically votes for a Democrat. But the way the congressional maps are drawn, there's almost zero chance that a Democrat could ever win any of the four seats, leaving those 30-35% without a meaningful representation. So several groups, the League of Women Voters of Utah and the Mormon Women for Ethical Government, along with a number of individual voters who said they would be disenfranchised, filed a lawsuit. We've seen these lawsuits across the country, North Carolina, New York, Maryland, other places, Alaska, Ohio. They've all filed lawsuits challenging the maps as disenfranchising them, taking away a meaningful vote and meaningful representation. So the state has asked for the case to be dismissed. They also asked for an injunction to be issued blocking the case from moving forward until the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, is looking at ruling on a case out of North Carolina, where the North Carolina Supreme Court struck down the maps that had been drawn there, A couple legislators appealed, saying the courts really should have no authority. So that's the case that's before the Supreme Court. The state wanted to wait on Utah's litigation until they've ruled on that. In the meantime, the judge rejected that request and said, no, we can go ahead and move forward with this. If the Supreme Court rules the way the state thinks that they might, then we can reassess at that point.
Yeah.
So the case is going to move forward. There was also a motion to dismiss. There were arguments on that, similar lines of argument. The state attorneys were saying, well, no, this is not a question for the courts to decide. This is a legislative matter, and the court should butt out, basically. The plaintiffs, the people who were bringing the challenge, said, well, you know, there's a free and fair elections clause in Utah,
right,
and many other states. And if you don't have the fairness piece of it, then the free part of it doesn't really matter. It's not a matter of just like being able to vote. It's having an opportunity for that vote to actually count. So
yeah.
So the judge hasn't ruled on that. She will, I would imagine, probably within a couple weeks. But there are some heavy issues that she's going to have to weigh here.
Right. You followed this hearing, and you live tweeted out what was being said by the different attorneys. And I mean, the heart of the state's argument is that the state says this is the legislature's purview. The Constitution says that the legislature has authority over this. Again, the free and fair thing is what the plaintiffs say. What could happen here, Robert? Meaning, could the judge say the state was wrong to have drawn the maps the way they did, or using the process they did? And then if the judge does say that, what's the remedy?
So we're still in the early stages right now. The remedy thing, that is a question that the state also raised. This is just on the motion to dismiss, so whether the case can actually move forward. Once it moves forward, then you do discovery. It's a fairly long process.
Right.
It's long enough to the fact that they're not even sure they can get the maps drawn by 2024 without the delays, if they're thrown out. Now, so the options the judge would have is that, you know, she can just declare these unconstitutional, send it back to the legislature to draw a new map. They can call a special session. There's some question whether the judge would have the authority to draw a map herself or designate a special master to draw a map. That's what happened in North Carolina. So, but that's at least, you know, a couple years down the road, a year and a half down the road at least.
Well, gentlemen, I'm sorry that we blew through the clock here, and I to save time for a recorded segment on that AP reporting on the hotline for sex abuse reporting that was set up by the LDS Church, we're going to have to do our underplayed stories of the week quickly. Brian Maffley, a very quick pick. What do you got?
This is my favorite part of the hour. So Anastasia Huffman, one of our interns, did a really fun story about some climbers who came across some unexploded ordnance up in Lone Peak Cirque while doing some trail restoration up there. Like, now how this, you know, piece of military hardware got there seems to be quite a mystery. It's not from, you know, shooting avalanches or
right.
And it seems kind of weird that there would be artillery training at, you know, the 12,000 feet or 10,000 feet.
I'm fascinated by the thing that first came to mind was the Japanese balloons that were sent over during World War II that had bombs attached to them. Do you remember this? Have you ever heard this story? Anyway, great story by Anastasia Huffman. I'm going to have to cut you off, Brian. I'm so sorry. But thank you for that pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Check it out at sltrip.com. Gerke, your pick.
The Inland Port Authority has a new boss. Ben Hart is going to be taking over the Inland Port Authority. This is this ongoing saga with the, you know, legislators weren't happy with the old boss and they weren't happy with the old board. They're trying to get this thing moving because it's being delayed, and so you can check that out at sltrip.com.
Interesting story. Sorry to make you rush through it, but I appreciate it. With that, I will say goodbye to my two guests, Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke, both of the Tribune. Thanks for being here.
Yep, thank you.
So long.
Yep, so long. We're going to take another really quick break in the show, and there is more to come. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we'll feature a bit of a conversation two Salt Lake Tribune religion journalists had with Associated Press reporter Michael Resendiz as part of the Trib podcast Mormonland. In his recent expose, Resendiz reported that an Arizona bishop with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints found out that a member of his ward was sexually abusing his own 5-year-old daughter. The bishop then called a church hotline here in Salt Lake City, and according to what this bishop later told law enforcement, he was advised by church attorneys that he was legally bound to keep the abuse secret because he learned about it during a counseling session the church considers a spiritual confession. That sexual abuse wasn't reported to law enforcement, and it then went on for as many as 7 more years. Michael Resendiz, by the way, was part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Boston Globe that uncovered the Roman Catholic Church's pattern of covering up clergy sex abuse, something that was documented in the Oscar-winning film Spotlight. Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce, who oversees the Tribune's faith coverage, and senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack spoke to Michael Resendiz for a recent episode of Mormonland.
So, Michael, let's start. How did you land upon this story? And did you know much about Latter-day Saints and their church before this?
I knew a little bit, but I cannot say that I was an expert in any way. But I generally read stories about the Mormon Church whenever I came across them in the newspapers, primarily because of my interest in the Catholic Church. But I knew something of the Mormon Church, but not a great deal. Mm-hmm. I got interested in this story when I read a small piece about the case in West Virginia, and it referred to these sealed records, and there were people quoted as kind of summarizing or trying to describe what was in the sealed records. And my thought was, well, why don't we get the records, you know, see what they really say. Let's see what's in there. And initially, I was talking with our attorney at the Associated Press, and we had this idea that we would file a motion to intervene in the case. And in the public interest, meaning the safety of children, we would try to have the seal undone. We would try to have the records unsealed. And we did contact an attorney in West Virginia who was going to do that for us. But I was making a lot of calls, just as I normally would. And in the course of making those calls, I ran into someone who gave me the records. I mean, there are a lot of people who have these records, but I did run into someone who decided they were just going to give me the records. And so at that point, I decided to just start reporting based on the records that I had, rather than get into a long, drawn out legal process that we might win or lose.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go about then reporting it, especially this Arizona case, which is just horrific?
Well, I did have a source in Arizona who told me about this case just as something very remarkable that was developing. And I took a look at that as well. And gosh, you know, I've been doing these institutional child sex abuse stories on and off for 20 years, and this seemed exceptional in a variety of ways. One of which was the degree of the abuse was so shocking and unfathomable that I guess it grabbed my interest for that reason initially. But as I did more reporting, I found a lot of people who wanted to help out, and I was able to get a lot of the crucial records in that case as well.
So in your article that you published, it presumes that the Arizona case is just the tip of the iceberg, that this is a pattern for the LDS Church. Do you know of, or are you working on any other cases?
Well, I don't think I ever said it was a pattern, but, you know, because of the Arizona case and the West Virginia case and some others that have been filed, I thought it was interesting and important to describe what I learned, because the entire operation of the helpline and the reporting of child sex abuse cases to the church is enveloped in secrecy. And it struck me that, you know, we have no idea how many reports are being made, how many of those reports are referred to law enforcement. I would assume that quite a few are, and how many are not. There's just no transparency whatsoever. So I thought that the thing to do is just to describe the process. And the process is that, you know, all the records of calls made to the helpline are destroyed at the end of each day. And, you know, when there's a serious case and someone answering the call to the helpline refers it to an attorney with the law firm of Curtin McConkie, then those conversations, the church insists, are all covered by attorney-client privilege. And then when you have a disciplinary proceeding, those records are also confidential. And so it just seems like it's kind of a locked box when it comes to allegations of child sex abuse in the Mormon church. And I thought, you know, this is a box that in the interest of the safety of children, really needs to be pried open. And that was really the purpose of the story.
I had a question quickly on the destroying of the records to the helpline. That seems like that could end up being problematic legally if the lawsuit's filed, and certainly lawsuits have and are being filed.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's troubling to say the least. And I have to say, I didn't really get into this in the story, but I found many instances where people associated with the church or members of the church were shredding documents or destroying documents relating to child sex abuse, or just destroying documents almost as a matter of course, almost as a like an unspoken policy. I mean, for instance, Lisa Adams, who was Paul Adams' wife, after federal agents raided their home and seized electronic devices with thousands of pornographic photographs and nearly 1,000 videos, many of them featuring the Adams children. I mean, after all that, according to her own testimony, she began shredding documents, anything with her husband's name on it. And she had the assistance of a visiting teacher from the Mormon church. The two of them were shredding documents. And that's according to Lisa's own testimony. And also, I just didn't have room for everything in the story, but, you know, I interviewed the older daughter, MJ, multiple times. And, she told me that she participated in the shredding of the documents that the kids did. And the kids just thought it was like a party. It was like, you know, it was, they were just having fun, you know, you know, shredding documents, you know? So, in the sealed records from West Virginia, there were many instances where bishops said that they, or not just bishops, but the clerks for various meetings that the bishops would convene, the church, these clerks would say that just as a matter, they didn't keep the records, they just destroyed them. And it seemed to be like an unwritten, it was a practice, if not an unwritten policy. And I just noted that throughout my research, there seemed to be many, many instances of destroyed records.
In your reporting, did you come upon any instances in which the LDS Church's helpline actually helped the victims?
You know, I'm sure there are many such instances. I mean, when I don't have any specifically, but when I interviewed Bill Maladon, he's the attorney, the Arizona attorney who's representing the Mormon Church in the Adams case. I mean, he told me that there were hundreds of cases where calls to the helpline had been referred to law enforcement. And I found that interesting. And I tried to get him to, you know, put that information on the record, but the church considers all that confidential. So I said to him, and I did put that in my story, that he said there were hundreds of instances. But I think what's relevant is, you know, that's an isolated, what should I call it? It's an isolated data point. The other data point is how many calls are not referred, and then what's the overall rate of referral? I mean, that's the only way to kind of make anything meaningful of that statement, I think. But I have no doubt that there are many instances where calls were reported to law enforcement. I mean, I guess I couldn't, would surprise me, I guess, just as a human being and as a practical matter, if there were not cases that were referred to law enforcement.
In its news release, the church complained, without pointing to any errors in the story, that your piece mischaracterized the nature and purpose of the church's helpline. What's your response to the church's response?
Well, you know, I personally think I characterize the helpline better than it's ever been characterized before, for a start. And, you know, I think what the church is referring to is I didn't underscore what they always say about the helpline, which is that its purpose is to give bishops guidance when it comes to reporting child sex abuse, and therefore, in that way, help the victims of child sex abuse. However, I did say, and I quoted the church's policies from their handbook, so I thought that was a little disingenuous. And overall, though, there was nothing in the church's statement about the Arizona case. There was nothing in their statement about the sealed records from West Virginia. And of course, those two subjects were really the drivers of the story. So I thought, if you're going to put out a statement criticizing my story and not point to any inaccuracies and not address the major revelations in the story, well, what's the statement worth, you know?
So what surprised you the most in your reporting this story?
Well, I guess what surprised me the most and continues to surprise me to this day is that two bishops and attorneys for the church in Salt Lake City could allow abuse of this nature to go unreported for so long. I mean, as a human being, I find that difficult to understand. Now, what the church says is that Bishop John Herod, who is the one who heard Paul Adams reveal his abuse, that he only learned it on one occasion and didn't know the abuse was ongoing. That's the church's position. However, the federal agents who interviewed Bishop Herod recorded the interview, and I've listened to the recording and I have a transcript of the interview, and it just seems to me that the context of their conversation was held as if the bishop knew the abuse was ongoing. For instance, the bishop was seeing Paul Adams for counseling, so Paul Adams was coming in on a regular basis for counseling. This wasn't was not a confession in the way that, say, people in the Catholic faith think of a confession, which is seeking forgiveness for a past bad act. This was ongoing counseling, and at one point the bishop called in Paul Adams's wife and made him tell her about the abuse so she would know what was going on if she didn't already, so that she could make some attempt to help protect their children. And at one point he said, as these counseling sessions continued, one of the purposes was to see whether the abuse had stopped. And so, as I said, the conversation between the federal agents and Bishop Herod reads as though there was a knowledge that the abuse was ongoing. That is my interpretation of what was said during that recorded interview.
Do you think the Bishop Herod knew the extent of it? I mean, like you, I find it horrifying that any human wouldn't be horrified.
Well, yes, of course. There are two indications that he had some idea of the extent of the abuse, and I'll tell you what they are. Bishop Herod was also Lisa Adams' personal physician. And he told the federal agents that in his view, she met the definition of, as he put it, battered woman syndrome. And when they discussed the older daughter, the victim of Adams's abuse, Bishop Herod said, without any prompting from the federal agents, something to the effect of, I don't think she'll ever be the same again. So it's pretty clear he had some idea that Lisa Adams was not capable of protecting her children, and that the older daughter had been severely damaged by it. And yet he did nothing, really.
It seems like we have to ask this. How did what you discover in this case involving the LDS Church compare to what the Spotlight team exposed about the priest abuse scandal in and around Boston?
Well, I mean, what we discovered in Boston, we had the Catholic Church does not destroy its records. And so we were able to get thousands and thousands of pages of internal records from the Boston Archdiocese. And initially, we got 10,000 pages of records just on one priest, John Gagan, who was the subject of our opening story. And we were able to show that the head of the Boston Archdiocese, Cardinal Bernard Law, and his predecessor, Cardinal Medeiros, knew that this particular priest had been abusing children for 30 years in six different parishes and had nevertheless allowed the abuse to continue. So we had a much more detailed, and then we got additional records showing that, there were up to 90 priests just in the Boston Archdiocese who were abusers. Today, by the way, that number is up to 250. But in any event, we were able to get thousands of pages, as I put it, of records of the Boston Archdiocese, which showed that there was a systemic problem at that point, at least within the Boston Archdiocese. We were not able to show that this was a systemic problem church-wide, although it's clear now that this is a global phenomenon within the Catholic Church.
So many people have pointed to issues with the LDS Church's helpline, saying that being staffed largely by attorneys, it's put under risk management division of the church. It's mainly right. To protect the church from liability. What reforms did some of your sources suggest for the system?
You mean for the system in the
to make it more effective in the Mormon Church? Yeah.
Well. There were not a whole lot of specific suggestions for reform, but I mean, just as a basic matter, I mean, I think most clinicians and experts in child sex abuse will agree, maybe not all, but I would certainly say probably most agree that, child sex abuse has a home in secret environments. I mean, in the Catholic Church, for instance, there's an all-male clergy, which is in effect a secret society. It's answerable only to the bishop, who sees his mission as protecting the church from scandal. So it's a good place for child molesters and child predators to hide. And just as a theoretical matter, you can make the same argument about the Mormon Church. There was a secret process for reporting child sex abuse. I mean, one reform would be very simple, which is to follow the letter of the law. In other words, most of the mandatory child sex abuse reporting laws say that anyone with knowledge or belief that child sex abuse or neglect is happening, these people are the specific people required to report can vary, but essentially they are required to immediately report to law enforcement or child protection services. And in Arizona, that's what the law says, quote, immediately report, end quote. But the Mormon Church says, no, you don't immediately report, you call the helpline. And somebody at the helpline takes the call, and somebody who answers the helpline decides whether it should be referred to an attorney. And if it is referred to an attorney, there's a conversation shrouded in secrecy between the attorney and the church leader. And at some point, either the allegation of abuse gets reported or it does not. In the meantime, the victim is maybe continuing to be abused, and the perpetrator may find out that someone has dropped a dime on him or her, although it's usually a him, and either cajole, threaten the victim into not talking or flee the state. Any number of things can happen during a delay. So one reform would be very simply to just call the police.
Even if it comes through a confession, right?
Well, You know, that's a trickier issue, but I will say this, that there are states that grant the clergy penitent privilege, but not in cases of child sex abuse. Mm-hmm. Tennessee would be one of those, where there is an acknowledgement of the clergy penitent privilege, but not when a child is being abused. Also, and I had kind of an interesting academic conversation with Bill Maldon about this. He's the, as I said, he's the attorney who represents the church in the case in Arizona. And there have been some law review articles written saying that the clergy penitent privilege should be amended so that a bishop or anyone hearing a confession, whether it's a Catholic priest or a Mormon bishop, would be required to report an ongoing crime. In other words, the act of seeking repentance for a past bad act would remain confidential. But if the Mormon bishop or the priest hears a confession in which it is revealed that the crime is ongoing, then the clergy person would be required to report that crime. That's how the attorney-client privilege works, by the way. So another reform would be, well, let's change the clergy penitent privilege to mirror the attorney-client privilege and not give so much leeway to the clergyman. I also should say that the clergy penitent privilege in Arizona gives the clergy person the option of reporting or not reporting. It gives the clergy person the option to decide whether the information was received during a confession or not, and then gives that person the option to decide whether to report or not. So the attorney-client privilege, at least under Arizona law, is not a requirement mm-hmm. to keep information about child sex abuse secret.
So what is the status of the lawsuit from the three children or the three people in the Arizona abusers case?
Sure. Well, the case will continue. The church has filed a motion to have the case dismissed. And in this motion, the church argues that everything, the church says that the case, and I'm quoting from the motion, hinges entirely on the clergy penitent privilege. There's an argument about that, and I'm going to publish a story in the Associated Press probably tomorrow saying that the clergy penitent privilege may not apply because Paul Adams posted the videos on the internet, and he bragged about his abuse on social media, and he, after all, he confessed his abuse to federal agents. So the seal of confidentiality was breached by Paul Adams, by the person who made the confession. So there's an argument, and this is an argument that was, this point was made to me by the Cochise County attorney who's opened a criminal investigation of the church. There's also an argument that Bishop Herod was required to report the abuse in his capacity, his professional capacity as a physician. So I think ultimately this question will be decided by a judge or a jury, but it just seemed to me that if the church says that this case is all about the clergy penitent privilege, the arguments could get quite interesting.
So if you had to do it over, is there anything you would do differently?
In terms of like living my life or writing the story?
No, your story. your life is off limits.
I wish I could have written more. I mean, the story was pushing 5,000 words, which for the Associated Press is a very, very long story. And I'm grateful that I had the space, but I could have written more. So.
Spoken like every reporter I've ever
exactly.
known, right?
So.
Yeah, it's probably true.
What response have you had to the article?
Well, I've been deluged, frankly, with email and Twitter DMs and every other form of communication, mostly from Mormons and former Mormons alike. And it seems that everybody has a tale about child sex abuse not being reported in the Mormon church. I mean, I would say something like, I don't know, maybe 10% of the communications I've received have come from supporters of the church. But, even the people who say that they're they believe in the church, they believe in church doctrine. You know, a lot of those people have also said, you know, something could be done to make this a better process and one that does more to protect children in the church. So I've been, like I say, deluged with communications from Mormons and ex-Mormons and non-Mormons alike, just saying that something more should be done or could be done. And as I said before, you know, before 1995, the church policy for church leaders was just follow the local reporting laws. You know, that's it. Fairly simple. And then the policy of the helpline was instituted in 1995. And this was a time of increasing vulnerability for organized religion when it came to lawsuits filed by victims of child sex abuse. This was a time when more of these lawsuits were being filed and juries were starting to award millions of dollars for the victims. The other piece of this is that the Mormon Church is particularly vulnerable when it comes to litigation, because unlike the Catholic Church, which is in a corporate sense decentralized, I mean, in a theological sense, it's very centralized, but in a corporate sense in the United States, church is divided into something like 300 different dioceses. So if you're an abuse victim in New York or an abuse victim in Amarillo, Texas, you know, you have to file against your local diocese, and that diocese may have plenty of money or it may not have plenty of money. But the Mormon church is organized as one corporate entity. So essentially, if you file a lawsuit against the Mormon church, you're looking at access to billions of dollars.
Yeah, really. Since the church may have just one big stash of cash, right? Of money.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I mean, it may have more than one stack of cash, but it's all controlled by you know, the prophet, essentially.
Yeah, the same entity.
Uh-huh. So you can't sue the Vatican. You have to sue this.
That's correct. I mean, there have been many attempts to sue the Vatican, and to my knowledge, they've all failed.
Yeah.
Well, Michael Resendiz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, listen, it's been my pleasure. I really appreciate the chance to be on your show, and it's been great to meet you both.
You can find episodes of the Salt Lake Tribune podcast, Mormonland, over at sltrib.com or through your podcast app. And that does it for our show today. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and is heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio. You can find past podcasts of this show and all of our local programs over at kcpw.org. And if you feel up to it, please consider making a pledge of support there as well. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once more for tuning in, and join us again next Friday.